My name is Katie Kelso, and I am the solicitor in charge of care and protection at Legal Aid New South Wales. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I am on, land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from which you are listening today. Today, I'm really excited to be joined by Deanne Nelligan. Deanne is one of our incredibly experienced care lawyers who works in our Appeals and Complex Litigation Unit representing parents and children in complex matters and appeals. She has also worked in litigation at Legal Aid and formerly at the Crown Solicitor's Office. Deanne, welcome and thank you for joining me to talk today about orders. It's going to be all about the different types of orders that the Children's Court can make today. Today we will be talking about parental responsibility orders, short-term care orders and guardianship orders. So final orders can be in place for different periods of time, for some children until they are 18 years, for others up to a period of 2 years, and these are known as short-term care orders. So to put all of this in context, Deanne, talk to me briefly about the permanent placement principles. Where are lawyers going to find these?
Certainly, and thank you, Katie. It's good to be here. So before I start, just to know that all of the sections that I'm referring to today are from the Children and Young Persons Care and Protection Act of 1998, and that's the super important one to remember when you're doing any work in this space. But as for the permanent placement principles, when a court makes a final determination about the appropriate orders that are made in relation to a child or young person under the Act, they have to consider those permanent placement principles, which are set out at Section 10A(3) of the Act, and that's having regard to the objects of the Act, which they'll find in Section 8, and the principles for administration of the Act, which are set out in Section 9. So in accordance with Section 10A(3A) of the Act, if it's practicable and in the best interests of a child or young person, the first preference for the court is for the child to be placed, restored to the care of his or her parents, or to a parent, so as to be able to preserve that family relationship. Section 83(1) of the Act requires the Secretary during the course of care proceedings to assess whether there is a realistic possibility of the child being restored to his or her parents within a reasonable period, having regard to the circumstances of the child or young person, and the evidence, if any, that the child or young person's parents are likely to have addressed some of the issues that led to the children coming to the attention of the department and being removed from the parent in the first place. Section 83(2) says that if the Secretary assesses that there is a realistic possibility of restoration within a reasonable period, and that's a period of 2 years within the Care Act, the Secretary is to prepare a permanency plan involving restoration and submit it to the Children's Court for consideration. We refer to that plan as a care plan. Section 82(3) says if the Secretary assesses that there is not a realistic possibility of restoration, the Secretary is to prepare a permanency plan for another suitable long-term placement for the child or young person and then provide that to the Children's Court for consideration. Further, Section 83(7A) mandates that the court must not make a final order until it expressly finds that permanency planning for the child or young person has been appropriately and adequately addressed. Section 78 mandates that if the Secretary applies to the Children's Court for an order, they must present the care plan, this is where the care plan comes into it, to the Children's Court before the final care orders are made. The section also sets out the different matters which are to be included in the care plan. This includes a bit of a history about how the child came into care, but also arrangements for contact between the child or young person and their parents, relatives, friends, and other relevant persons.
Thanks, Deanne, for that snapshot. Now, listeners will have already been able to watch some of our videos and also listen to some of our other podcasts, which are going to have covered in more detail interim orders, but also more about restoration and permanency planning. But what we haven't covered as yet is actually what parental responsibility is all about. Deanne, can you tell us what does the Act say about what parental responsibility means?
Certainly. So under Section 3 of the Act, parental responsibility means all the duties, powers, responsibilities and authorities which, by law, parents have in relation to their children. So basically that's all of the everyday decisions that parents ordinarily make for children.
And when the court comes to make final orders about the allocation of parental responsibility, there are a few options, aren't there? We're talking about parental responsibility potentially being allocated to the secretary, being allocated to parents, being allocated to one parent, to relatives, to someone within a kinship group, carers. There's all sorts of options, aren't there? And Section 79 tells us a little bit about what the options are for the court, doesn't it?
That's right. That's correct. It certainly recognises that for each child, what is best for them will be different. And sometimes that is the minister being responsible for all aspects of parental responsibility. Sometimes it's the minister working alongside a parent or a grandparent. Sometimes it's for a parent or a grandparent to have sole parental responsibility. All different kinds of options are contemplated by the Act. And yes, that's all set out in Section 79 of the Act. One of the most common orders that we do see is the secretary asking the court to make orders for the minister to have parental responsibility for children, sometimes until the children turns 18, but other times for a much shorter period. And I think often what we see is when children come before the children's court, that's because their parents have been assessed as not being in a position to make those parental decisions for them, and they're not quite at a point where they can make those decisions for them at the end of the proceeding. So it's often that the minister will have some or all aspects of parental responsibility at the conclusion of care proceedings.
And it's not always the case, is it, that one person will hold all aspects of parental responsibility, is it? Sometimes it's more appropriate for particular children to have various aspects of parental responsibility allocated to different people. And an example that comes to mind is perhaps an Aboriginal child where one or multiple people might hold parental responsibility for culture while the minister might hold the other aspects. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. The court can allocate specific aspects of parental responsibility pursuant to 79(2) of the Care Act. And this recognises, as you say, that there are particular people in the lives of children who are probably better placed to support them and make decisions about areas than others. And that can also be if we have a parent who has parental responsibility but is not in a position where they could supervise contact with another parent, we often find that the minister will hold parental responsibility for contact while one parent will have sole parental responsibility to the exclusion of other. And culture, as you said, is also a really important one because families play such an important part in supporting and educating their kids in culture.
So I think, would you agree that the takeaway message for lawyers that are experienced but also new to the jurisdiction to just think through every individual case and think through who's the most appropriate person to hold various aspects of parental responsibility? Don't just assume that it all has to be held by the one person. Is that a good takeaway message for people?
That's absolutely a good takeaway message for people. And I think it's really important because for some families there will be aspects of their religion or culture that is really important, and they want their children to know that whether their children are living with them or not. So that's absolutely a really important thing to consider when you're representing parents. Is there a particular thing that your client can be responsible for that will continue to be important in the life of their child?
So we're going to move on to talk about a type of order called short-term care orders that really came out of the legislative changes that were made and came into effect at the beginning of 2019. And it really was one of the most significant changes, I think, to practice in the children's court. So Section 83(9), short-term care orders, can you talk us through what a short-term care order is?
So orders that are made under the Care Act allocating parental responsibility for a period of 2 years or less, they're known as short-term care orders. The rationale behind the introduction of short-term care orders was that, unlike an order allocating parental responsibility to the minister until 18 years of age, a short-term care order would encourage timely action by caseworkers and parties to achieve a permanent placement for children and young people within a clear time frame. So we wouldn't have children kind of languishing in the care system until the age of 18. Although there was much discussion about these kinds of orders as part of the amendments, honestly, they aren't seen very often in practice anymore, and applications by the department to seek these orders have been largely unsuccessful. Where all aspects of parental responsibility are allocated to the minister under Section 79(1)(b) of the Act, 7919 will apply. This section provides that the maximum period, which an order under subsection 1B may allocate all aspects of parental responsibility to the minister following the court's approval of a permanency plan involving restoration, guardianship or adoption, is 24 months. So that's where the two-year thing comes in. And this is subject to section 79.110, which provides that subsection 9 does not apply if the children's court is satisfied there are special circumstances that warrant allocation for a longer period. What constitutes special circumstances is not defined in the Care Act, nor has there been any judicial consideration of this term in the context of the section. So it's still a bit of a watch this space. But the reality is nobody gets to the point of considering where that is because we don't see many successful considerations of short-term care orders.
And while there haven't been many cases that deal with that particular issue, there certainly have been some cases about short-term care orders in general, haven't there?
Yes.
I think it's probably fair to say it's been quite a controversial topic and something that the court has been grappling with since the introduction of the changes to the legislation. Can you take us through sort of the cases that practitioners really need to know about when they're working in this space?
Certainly. There are really three published decisions of the Children's Court which consider the issue of short-term care orders. These happened very early on, shortly after the legislation was amended. And in each of these cases, the short-term care orders sought by the department were not made by the court. The first matter considering the issue is a matter called the Secretary versus the Stonsky Children. And I understand the references will be available, the citation will be available elsewhere. In that matter, Magistrate Hayes was asked to consider asked by the secretary to consider making short-term care orders in relation to three siblings who had all been placed with carers, the same carer, during the course of children's court proceedings, with a longer-term goal of the children being adopted by these carers. The independent legal representative argued that the requirements of permanency planning were not met because the children had only recently been placed with the carers, because there was too much uncertainty about whether their adoption by those carers would proceed, and also, it was unlikely that the adoption process would be finalised within a period of 2 years. In those circumstances, the ILR categorised the plan as aspirational. Ultimately, however, His Honour accepted that the adoption process was unlikely to be finalised within 2 years. And in those particular circumstances, he considered that permanency planning had not been adequately and appropriately addressed unless the care plan also provided for the secretary to bring a Section 90 application if the adoption was delayed or did not proceed, given the risk that parental responsibility would otherwise automatically revert to parents who were unsuitable.
So a bit of a plot twist in that one, really.
Yes.
So tell us about the next decision, which is a decision of the president in the matter of Department of Communities and Justice and Teddy.
So after the Stonsky children was this matter of Teddy that President Johnston considered, and in that matter he looked at what it meant for a care plan to involve guardianship. And this decision's actually turned out to be a really important one because it's most often seen that short-term care orders will be sought where guardianship is the ultimate goal. In this matter, His Honour was asked to approve an amended care plan in relation to a baby who was placed with his proposed long-term carers, who were his paternal aunt and uncle. The care plan proposed that aspects of parental responsibility be allocated to the carers, and the care plan said that it was anticipated that within 12 months, the department would undertake a guardianship assessment of the paternal aunt and uncle. The care plan also set out several steps that would be undertaken in the first 6 months following the making of final orders, with an assessment for guardianship to be made after that. In considering that care plan and in his judgment, His Honour confirmed that Section 79.9 did not apply to Teddy in circumstances where there was a proposal for an allocation of parental responsibility that did not involve allocation of all aspects to the minister. And further, His Honour concluded that the permanency plan proposed by the Secretary was not one involving restoration, guardianship or adoption, but rather a plan that contemplated the possibility of a guardianship application being made sometime in the future.
Okay, and then we had one final case, the matter of Jack and Jill, which was a decision of Magistrate Williams in the Port Kembla Children's Court, and that came after the decision in Ree Teddy. Do you want to run us through what happened in that case?
Certainly. In the matter of Jack and Jill, Magistrate Williams considered the President's decision in Teddy and applied that to his case, and His Honour applied the principle that permanency planning involves guardianship only if guardianship is a necessary or integral part or result. And he concluded that the permanency plan before him in Jack and Jill was not one involving guardianship. His Honour expressed the view that although guardianship did not have to be a certainty, there had to be a reasonable degree of inevitability about the ultimate making of the guardianship order. In His Honour's view, more than a mere desire or intention to proceed in the direction of guardianship was required.
So there was a lot, there was a long way to go, wasn't there, in terms of between when these carers were potentially going to be assessed as suitable to be guardians for Jack and Jill, wasn't there? And I think an important thing to note as well is that the circumstances of that case were that the carers had actually indicated at that stage that they were not wanting to be considered as guardians. So that's an interesting point.
That's right. I think they'd indicated that they might be willing to consider guardianship at some point in the future.
So we're still a long way off.
And certainly no evidence about whether she would or would not be a suitable guardian.
Hmm. So thank you for those case summaries, Deanne. We're going to move on to another type of order, which is a guardianship order. And these have been around a little longer than the short-term care orders, but they are quite different to an order for parental responsibility just being allocated to one of the people that we've mentioned previously. Can you talk us through what a guardianship order is all about?
Certainly. So it's important to say that when the court is asked to make an order allocating parental responsibility to the minister or to someone else on section 79, the court must also consider whether it's more appropriate to make a guardianship order. In fact, the court cannot make an order for parental responsibility under section 79 if it would be more appropriate to make a guardianship order. And that's set out in section 79.4. And that's also how we now find in the care plans a section which contemplates guardianship and says, is guardianship a possibility in the future? So back to the question about guardianship and the difference to straight parental responsibility. So a guardian is essentially a person who has all aspects of parental responsibility for a child allocated to them. But this is pursuant to section 79A7, a guardianship order can only be made as a final order, and that order remains in force until the child attains the age of 18 years, unless the order is varied or rescinded. And also a guardianship order may allocate parental responsibility jointly to more than one person. And often we see, for example, aunt and uncle or, a couple, we often see them sharing guardianship under a guardianship order. Most commonly, we see applications for guardianship brought before the court by the secretary, but they can also be made under the Act by a designated agency responsible for supervising a child's placement or by a person seeking to be allocated aspects of parental responsibility pursuant to that guardianship order, provided that the secretary has given consent to both of those bringing applications.
And there are certainly a lot of boxes that need to be ticked under the Act and also the regulations, aren't there, in terms of applying for and obtaining a guardianship order?
That's right. An applicant for a guardianship order, so the secretary usually, must present to the court a suitability statement prepared by an assessment body which approves a person as being assessed as suitable to be a guardian. And that's not particularly different to what we see at parental capacity assessments, for example. A number of other documents must also be filed, including a financial plan, a care plan, and very importantly, a document confirming the consent of a young person if the young person's over the age of 12. And it's also a requirement and really important for the proposed guardians to obtain legal advice, and the court will need to be satisfied that they've had the opportunity and have done that.
And if people were looking for more information about the requirements before a guardianship order can be made, they should have a look at Part 4A of the Act and the regulations 79A through to 79E, shouldn't they?
Yeah.
One of the most significant differences between an order for parental responsibility and a guardianship order is probably something that can be considered to be both a positive and a negative, which is that they can't be made at the same time as any other orders are made.
That's right. Guardianship orders are essentially standalone orders. The Act prohibits the Children's Court from making a number of other orders in respect to a child who's a subject of a guardianship order, and this includes supervision orders, an order accepting undertakings, orders requiring the secretary to supervise the children's contact, or even the order for provisions of Section 82 reports, which we find are often really important to let everybody know how the child is going once final orders are made. All of those things are not possible if a guardianship order is made.
And that's a really important consideration for practitioners when they're giving advice, isn't it? And also child representatives when they're considering prospective guardians, I think. And it also ties in with what Section 83, subsection 3B says, because the court has to be satisfied that a prospective guardian will provide a safe, nurturing, stable and secure environment for the child or young person and will continue to do so in the future. Mm. And so really when the court is looking at that, they have to be satisfied that the prospective guardian can do all of those things without essentially any of the safety netting that we might see or additional support that might come from those additional orders that can be attached to parental responsibility orders. So when acting for a parent, Deanne, what are some of the most important things to consider when advising a parent if a guardianship order is best for their child?
Yeah, so some of the things that you and your client would need to think about would be the level of support or monitoring which has been required and which may continue to be required from the department of the placement, whether the carer is able to arrange family contact, the level of financial support which will be available for a guardian, and this is particularly important if children have high needs or they require counselling or have additional needs that we often see in children who are subject to these care proceedings, whether the carer will be able to satisfy the assessment criteria and obtain the consent of the secretary to bring an application, if it's not the secretary making the application, and whether orders such as supervision or orders accepting undertakings are actually required and important in the case. The new amendments to the Act do provide that it's possible for the court to make a contact order for a period of longer than 12 months when making a guardianship order. And so the usual restriction of 12 months that we see does not apply. This is an important consideration because if there is an issue about the guardian being able to facilitate contact, it's possible to get a contact order to make sure that relationship continues. Another thing to keep in mind is, given the limited involvement of the secretary once a guardianship order is made, if there's a problem down the track in relation to contact between a child who is a subject of a guardianship order, it may be easier to obtain the consent of the minister pursuant to section 69ZK of the Family Law Act 1975 for any future proceedings involving the care of the child to be brought before the family court rather than needing to return to the children's court. Obviously, bringing proceedings before the family court brings another range of complications and those proceedings are much longer, but there may also be some benefits to a parent in going before that court rather than being before a court that's mostly focused on child protection. So that's just something to keep in mind and something that you may wish to give some advice about to clients in the future.
Mm, some very good tips there. And just to finish us off, have you got any tips for lawyers that might be new to the jurisdiction?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's really important for lawyers who are working in this jurisdiction to make sure they have a really clear understanding of the different kinds of orders that the Children's Court can make, and also to be in a position to give their clients a realistic assessment of what a court is most likely to do. The best outcomes that we see for parents are often if they get realistic advice, but they also have a lawyer who's working really closely with them to make sure they're taking every opportunity to deal with some of the issues which bring them before the court in the first place.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Deanne, for joining us today.
Thanks, Katie.